Good morning, everyone. Lovely to be here with so many people on a weekday morning. It's quite a unique thing for us on coming and going. It's a shame to have this many people here in the middle of the week. How lovely. So I'm going to try and give a talk this morning about one of our new pieces in our new fourth edition liturgy book. And I'm finding it quite a challenge to talk about these new pieces because before coming here, I guess I had a chance to read through all of them at least once, but that's pretty much it. So hopefully the ones that I'm actually talking about, I've had to read through at least a second time. But, I haven't had an opportunity to really live into them yet, you know, and get a feeling for what these mean to me, which I find takes quite a long while, actually, and is kind of a continuous process, because I find that even the ones that I've been exposed to, you know, hundreds, maybe even thousands of times, continue to open themselves to me if I continue to investigate them. So it's early days on these new ones. So you might want to bear with us as we're going through that process. And I may say some things that upon further review I don't fully stand behind. So I particularly welcome any objections that you might have during the Dharma dialogue. Unless they're really, really good objections, in which case I may not be quite as happy to receive them, but they will be even more useful in that case, perhaps. So I wanted to start with the long version of the sixth grave precept. Laura talked about this precept in her wonderful talk a couple of days ago. And the hearing of this is what triggered my interest in this particular one that I'm going to be trying to talk about today. And it had to do with this fault finding and also receiving with acceptance, unconditionally accepting. So, the longer version of this precept, we say, self-nature is subtle and mysterious. In the realm of the flawless Dharma, not expounding upon error is called the precept of not finding fault with others. In the Buddha Dharma, there is one path, one Dharma, one realization, one practice. Don't permit fault finding. Don't permit haphazard talk. Unconditionally accepting what each moment has to offer, I vow to take up the way of not finding fault with others. And I particularly wanted to read the long version of this because of this one sentence in here about in the realm of the flawless Dharma, not expounding upon error is called the precept of not finding fault with others. So to me, this applies not only to other people, but to the entire universe. Right? This, how could it be that there is this flawless Dharma that includes so many flaws? Quite a koan, isn't it? Flawless Dharma, including all these flaws of the world that we live in. read this piece, The Way of Tenderness. The way of tenderness does not equal quiescence. It does not mean that fiery emotions disappear. It does not render acceptable that anyone could hurt or abuse life. Tenderness doesn't erase the inequities we face in the relative world, and it doesn't encourage a spiritual bypass of the feelings we experience. The way of tenderness is an elixir for the clogged arteries in the heart of our world. Complete tenderness trusts the fluidity of our life energy and its extension into those around us. It allows rage and anger to flow in and out again, without holding on to it as proof of being human. We can let go of stockpiling our rage for fear that our suffering might go unrecognized, or that we'll appear apathetic or naive. This is a liberated tenderness, a way of lessening and finally removing the potency of our tragic past as sentient beings. Quite a powerful piece, I think. So this first bit, well, before I get into that, so this way of tenderness, I was really sitting with this yesterday. I think it was yesterday. I don't know. I'm a little unclear at this point when things were, but as I was doing Doksan and meeting with all of you individually, I had this way of tenderness in mind as I was doing that. And I was just very, you know, aware of trying to really meet each individual as they came in. Meeting with kindness. So we talked earlier, again, I'm a little confused at this point about who talked about what, but we talked about, you know, trying to meet with love, and if we can't do that, at least trying to meet with kindness, and if we can't do that, and so on. So it came up for me, this way of tenderness being the way of kindness, and I believe it was the Dalai Lama that said, my religion is kindness. So I think this is a very important item in Buddhism in general, or at least in Mahayana Buddhism, which is what we have in common with the Tibetans, is that we're all Zen and Tibetan Buddhists are all Mahayana Buddhists, even though our practices and texts are mostly different, although I think we have some in common. So kindness. The way of tenderness does not equal quiescence. It does not mean that fiery emotions disappear. And I don't know about you, but I'm no stranger to fiery emotions. And when they come up, I find that a rather difficult thing. I often blame myself for that arising. And so this way of kindness, this way of tenderness, does not equal fully eliminating our fiery emotions. It does not render acceptable that anyone could hurt or abuse life. So this is the line that came up to me when we were talking about the sixth precept the other night. This word, acceptable. So Laura suggested the word receiving as a possible alternative to accepting this unconditionally accepting what each moment has to offer. Thinking of it as unconditionally receiving. Because I don't know about you, but I can find this word accepting to be a little challenging. Because it sounds like, you know, so acceptance of whatever is showing up. And I don't actually, at least the way I normally think of the word acceptance, right, I don't think that's actually necessarily the correct response, right? That it's not like, oh yeah, so I'm actually okay with what's arising here, right? Because there's a lot of stuff. I mean, for me anyway, all I have to do is look at the news. And lately, this has been kind of a daily thing. There's at least one and probably several news items every day that I find just incredibly, massively, hugely unacceptable that this is going on. And these emotions rise up in me, and I think surely we don't mean by unconditionally accepting that I just have to accept this and say, well, everything's fine. And I think that's not at all what we're talking about with that precept. And this line, it does not render acceptable that anyone could hurt or abuse life. And this is key, right? We don't just go along with whatever is happening without really receiving the difficulty, the violence, the mistreatment of other human beings committed both by me and by others in the world. This is not just an illusion. This is actual reality that this is going on. And as part of our service to the world and all human beings, this is something we need to take a close look at. Tenderness doesn't erase the inequities we face in the relative world. And it doesn't encourage a spiritual bypass of the feelings we experience. So this is an easy thing to fall into with Zen practice, right? Is to think, so Zen is all about producing some inner state of peace and calm, and in the face of all this disturbing news, perhaps, you know, I'll just go do some Zazen and it won't bother me quite so much. And if that's how we're using our Zazen, I think we might want to take a closer look at that, because it feels to me like that might not be appropriate. We're not interested in a spiritual bypassing here. Of course, it's also occurring to me that there is, you know, so doing Zazen is not the problem, right? Because there definitely is very clearly a need to do Zazen with all of the disturbance that is arising, right? But rather than trying to paper over the disturbance, meeting this disturbance, right? And feeling this oneness of the universe, this flawlessness of the Dharma that is true in spite of even all of these disturbing flaws. Can we do that? I mean, that's a serious challenge, right? Is to allow all of this disturbance to come up and acknowledge that and really feel what it's like that people are being hurt. And that I'm even to blame for some of that. Even if I don't engage in these things directly, it's my karma. It's my family karma. It's my cultural karma. It's the world karma. And I am not separate from that. So the way of tenderness is an elixir for the clogged arteries in the heart of our world. So this is the role of our Zazen practice, I think, for me. This opening our hearts to the world. Opening my heart. Which is also, in a very important way, I think, receiving Kanzeihan's heart. The Bodhisattva of compassion. Bodhisattva of compassion actually is not separate from us. I think we as human beings entirely have this capacity to hear the cries of the world and be moved. Of course, as human beings, it slips away from us, right? But Kanzeihan is the archetype of this. And it's not foreign to us. Surely we all know what it's like to have our hearts touched by suffering and have this sense of compassion for the world to show up. When we really let suffering in and practice with it and sit in Zazen with it. And don't push it away, and don't try to turn it into something else. That it may turn into something else. And that something else for me that sometimes arises is this compassion for all beings. And a sense of ownership and responsibility for the troubles of the world. This is what shows up when we fully allow the suffering of individual beings and the world in general touch our heart. So, complete tenderness trusts the fluidity of our life energy and its extension into those around us. It allows rage and anger to flow in and out again. In and out again. Without holding on to it as proof of being human. Easy to use our own suffering, our accumulated rage and anger as proof that we're only human, and you don't understand all the pain and anger and rage that I have, and if only you knew, then you'd make allowances for me. So it's easy to use this sense of being wronged as an excuse that justifies our own wrong behavior. Particularly in the fight against what we see as injustice, right? I mean, this is very clearly going on, right? The separation into warring camps. It's like it seems to be the fundamental thing that's going on at this particular moment is that the whole world is dividing up into separate camps that can't communicate at all. We all have our separate news outlets. We all have our own view of what's going on. And all other views are called fake by both sides. It's really quite disturbing. We can let go of stockpiling our rage for fear that our suffering might go unrecognized. And we have, of course, been hurt. And it's important that these hurts be addressed. And without making some noise, people are not going to be aware of our suffering, are they? And this is true. But nonetheless, if we are stockpiling our rage, how do we get beyond that? This is not about eliminating rage, but this coming and going quality is important, right? How do we not live our entire life out of a sense of rage? And maybe that's the, you know, all we can do. But my hope for us would be that we don't fixate in any particular position and allow all of this hurt and anger and rage, much of it justified, to not get stuck in needing to punish the world for the injustices that have been done. Or, this is a liberated tenderness, a way of lessening and finally removing the potency of our tragic past as sentient beings. Tragic past as sentient beings. What a wonderful phrase. Because our past as sentient beings, as human beings, as a world on fire, is quite tragic. Look around. Tragedy everywhere. And yet, here we are. Can we hear the cries of the world and allow ourselves to be moved in ways that address even a tiny, tiny bit of this tragedy? Of course, we can't fix the world, but we can use whatever life energy we have in service of human beings and trying to remove at least a tiny bit of this tragedy. And if we dedicate ourselves to that, even partially, even only at moments, then perhaps that is enough. We did what we could do, and this is our Zen way of life. Thank you. So, I felt kind of warmed up. So please sit comfortably, and we'll have a Dharma dialogue. And,
I love that we're talking about this, because it's exactly an issue that I've been struggling with recently myself. And struggling with the issue of finding fault with others, seeing behavior that inflicts suffering on other people, and wanting to find fault with the person who's got the behavior.
Right.
And any way I looked at that, it just seemed to create more suffering, to find fault with the person who was generating the suffering. I couldn't see a positive outcome there, just more defensiveness. And yet, it was hard to watch the suffering that was going on as a result of it. And the place where I've come down is that the primary suffering is in the person who's inflicting the suffering on other people. Mm-hmm. And that's where we connect with compassion. And that's what we can do. Not find fault, but have compassion for the person who's expressing their suffering in ways that cause suffering to other people. And, you know, I think the extension of that is our political situation, exactly what you're talking about, where we feel like we have no way to understand or talk to these people who are doing these things that cause so much suffering. But that behavior comes out of a place of suffering. And I think that's what we can connect with, is having compassion for, you know, whatever is causing the suffering, the primary suffering. And deal with the secondary suffering in whatever ways we can, exactly as you say. But finding fault, obviously, isn't productive. I mean, we're doing a lot of it, and not getting too very far with it.
So a couple things. I totally agree with what you're saying, although the words primary and secondary, I find, are troubling me a little bit. Okay. And you're right. So primary in the sense of coming first is correct, right? So the person who's inflicting the harm is the first mover here, right?
Right.
And then the damage that is done, it comes after that. So in that sense, it's secondary, right?
But
I wouldn't want to think that, you know, the person who's inflicting the harm is the one who's primarily suffering.
No,
I'm just clarifying what you said, right? That's, which is fine, because I know that's what you meant, right?
Right.
Yeah. And also this fault finding, right? So it's really important not to ignore the harm that's being done.
Absolutely.
Right? As you point out, right? It's just that so this is not actually the fault of the person that's inflicting the harm, right? Because it's a universal thing, right? These people and these attitudes have arisen because of causes and conditions in the world,
right?
And they actually think that they're doing the thing that is necessary in order to preserve all of the stuff that they think is important. And it's so hard for us to see that, because it seems like none of the stuff that they care about is what we care about. And to a large extent, that's true, right? But nonetheless, their own pain, their own greed, anger, and ignorance is the only thing, right? And all of that comes from the whole world suffering, not this individual person, right? So to say, it's your fault, right, is wrong. Right? Even if we got rid of this person who we think has the fault, it would not eliminate the karma of the world that caused this to rise up at this moment. So, yes, please do not ignore the harm. But please do not think that it's the fault of some individual being, and if only we could get rid of them, then our troubles would be over, because this is not actually the case.
I want to just speak to this in a little bit of a different way. I'm so appreciative of your talk and this response you just gave to Fran. So appreciative of what you said, Fran. Because this has been a real problem for me this year. There's one particular person that I've really been struggling with, and I don't know him personally. We've never met. As far as I know, we've never even been on the same subway together, as far as I know. It's the president, right? And I think back to coming and going Sashin a few years ago. I don't remember when it was, just like you don't remember who gave what talk. I don't remember which coming and going Sashin this was, but it's when the marathon bombing happened. And we were all, some of us were here for that.
I was sitting right there.
You were sitting right there. It was just, oh my God. Right? And retreat, la la la. You know, there's bad stuff going on right now. I don't know anything about it because I haven't been following the news. Trying to, you know, take my vow. And one of the things we came to was in our discussions and kind of going over, wow, what is that those people who did the bombing, just like you said, they really had a very clear view of what was wrong and what they needed to do to correct it. And they were victims themselves, as you say, of their own, Well, anyone who takes up arms against another person is going to be changed by that. So, this way of taking all these different things and bringing them together, like that everyone has their own view, which is their view, which is to them logical and heartful. Right? And so that's one side. And then the other side, and I think you're both saying that in different ways, and I just want to say it in my way, is that every human being I've ever met causes harm. And we can't just go, oh, la, 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 right? We have to do some. That guy needed to be caught. He needed to be put on trial. You know, all that stuff. And then all the screwed up things that happened after that, that's another story. And the people who are opposing Trump also need to be doing that. You know, that I stand with them, right? And I also agree with you, and I thank you for clarifying primary and secondary, because these things arise in people. I don't know what his suffering is like when he's up all night tweeting. You know, I can, my heart can go out to him. But then I keep bringing it back to myself. And what I've noticed is that in my opposing him, in my generating anger and frustration towards this person, I'm practicing developing anger and frustration. It's like I've gotten really good at it this year. And I keep saying, oh, this has been a really hard year, this has been a really hard year. And there's been lots of stuff that happened, not just politically. But really? Has it been a hard year? Haven't the birds come back in the spring? Haven't the flowers grown? Haven't I been with people I love and care about? Isn't that true? You know, so what does it mean to have a hard year? It's crazy. But I've been generating a little box for myself out of the opposition to this human being. And so I feel like you're both pointing some to me, to some learning that I haven't quite finished learning. Maybe may I never finish it. To hold all these, and I think this is what the precepts ask us to do, actually, to hold multiple views. So the view of just cut this crap out is really important. And the view of, wow, everybody screws up, is also important. And the view that the Dharma is subtle and mysterious and there's no fault also is part of it. And then, and if I switch from one to the other, I do a disservice to reality. that I have to bring it all together. And that's what we're doing here, I feel. So I'm really so happy for both of you finding ways in, and that you allowed me to have a third way in. And I think every one of us has to find our way into this. This is a koan.
Yeah.
And just one last thing. Recently I was watching a documentary about Teddy Roosevelt, the elections of the turn of the last century, 1900. Same shit. It's unbelievable. People accusing each other of fake news and, you know, a war about, engaging in wars for no purpose and, you know, and killing people and killing animals randomly. Just the same kind. I think this is human being stuff. I think if there was newsreel footage of the Buddhist time, we'd see the same thing. Right? And what then the little bit we know from the Buddhist time is that people kept doing this stuff. So we're creatures who can be unkind in very serious ways. So it's up to us to examine that.
This is just one more point that's popped into my head. I think that, you know, sort of the corollary to this is we often dehumanize the person who especially afflicts egregious suffering. And I was so struck in the Sandy Hook massacre that Adam Lanza was never counted among the dead. What inconceivable suffering he had to have been experiencing. And so I guess that's where I feel like, you know, our compassion plays, you know, the compassion for even the person who commits the most egregious crime. And there's some.
Thank you, Frank. Chittak. And I was thinking about acceptable and receiving. But that's not what you talked about. Because in the face of suffering, the First Noble Truth, the invitation is to, I think, embrace the suffering fully. And what I think I tend to do, and a lot of people tend to do, is move to reacting way too quickly. And don't spend the time. And what's nice about being here is you're able to spend the time. And in life, right. You're not always able to spend the time. If you do act, being aware of your reactivity to, you know, that is what, and what's that reactivity coming from? What's behind it? You know, this rage, this anger, this fear, whatever that is, that, what is that? That's, I think, we're able to sit and the practice is that, clarity eventually arises, what you're pointing to, and that other part, you know, where all is well, piece of it, or that, yes, this can, and then there's clarity there, at the other end. And oftentimes we don't want to wait for the clarity. And clarity could be like the arising of compassion, you know, that, oh, this person's a human being, so my response to them would be different than if I just reacted out of my feelings of anger. But so for me, and what happens, my tendency is to wait for clarity too long, you know, and not act right away. So having that kind of balance, you know, of being able to be reactive and yet not giving in to the disturbed emotions, you know.
So. Yeah, thank you, Ray. So I'm not actually hearing much of a disagreement here, but so I don't think clarity and flawlessness and this quality of no problem, all of those are true, right? But I don't think that actually eliminates the other side, right, of the suffering and the reactivity and the anger and so if we wait for that to be gone, as you're pointing out, I think that might be waiting too long, right? So to clarifying the injury and you know, our sense of outrage is also clarity. Right. And you're right that there's also, you know, when you see the whole big picture, there's this sense of, you know, so it's actually okay in some mysterious way that things are as they are. And this is a real thing. This is the flawlessness of the Dharma that I was trying to point to. But you're right. I didn't emphasize that side of it because I wanted to emphasize this other side of allowing the hurt and the pain to come up in us and allow it to touch our heart and to be able to use that in the world before it turns into, you know, just, oh, well, okay, everything's fine. And yes, there's that aspect of it too, and thank you for pointing that out, Ray.
And did you say, Ray, that it contains, the clarity contains the...
Yes.
Right. And I might even push that a little further and say, it is it.
Okay.
Right? You know, that anger, the sort of Manjushri, turns into clarity because it's the same thing in different aspects. So we don't have to wait. We have to value in some way. I think I want to value it all.
And I just want to also make sure we don't get too monumental about this, because it sounds, I mean, and it is so important, it functions at every level, but it also functions at the micro level, and each one of us and not in the terrible things, but in the little things that come up, we get to practice. That's exactly what we're talking about. So it might not be for you a full-blown rage, but it may be just a little irritation at the person walking in front of you who's not quite doing it right. Right? And so important to practice. And then we get to experience suffering. We get to investigate time after time this arising, so that as these we face these overwhelming issues of our world and all of this, we then can make the connections, because we've been practicing some other response other than blame. Why doesn't David just walk better? Right? If only he, you know, so we get to see again and again and practice this, this new way that we're called to, this way of opening to the suffering. And the Buddha defined dukkha basically as life. You know, being born is dukkha. You know, having a body is dukkha. And we get to study the reactivity. This rage, and I love that, the coming and going, right? That we can really see. And maybe for you it's not rage or irritation, but it's sadness or depression. You know, it all comes and goes. And then to see, and Ray, this is where I think you're pointing to, that there is some resolution that is not us fixing it. And I think, you know, we're all pointing to this, that the thing is, we're not learning how to fix things. That the flawlessness only appears when we're willing to see what happens if we stop meddling. If I let it be, then everything that arises is the gift that transforms us, that liberates us. And this is our practice.
I learned a new verb recently, to other. Mm. And I'm thinking about what Melissa and Fran were talking about, taking the perspective of the person who seems to be causing the suffering, and to resist the temptation to other them. Because so often I find that the quality that I abhor in the other, I've got myself.
Yeah.
So, for example, my narrative about the behavior that we're observing in the political realm, particularly with respect to environmental issues, is that it's really about the fear of not having or being enough. And if we could only open all of the national parks and the forests and everything to drilling and getting more oil and natural gas and everything out, then we would have enough and we wouldn't have to worry about having enough or being enough or having enough status. And I think it's endless. It's never ending. So where I'm going with this is that I think we as Buddhists have something to offer here. I was with a teacher a year ago who said, it's okay that you haven't taken the precepts. Already Buddha. Oh, what a relief.
And what I hear, the connection you're making, this not enough, is that we get to see how not enough runs our life. And again, as Fran was saying, doesn't mean we don't do anything, but get to examine this not just as what those other people do, but boy, and we can begin to feel the power of that, how it runs our life, and then the work we're doing is all work for the world. We're working on this koan of greed, anger, and ignorance. And the wonderful thing then is that You don't have to wait to do something. You're not powerless. We have something that can be done right here. And not that we have to be perfect beings before we act in the world, but there is a way to meet this that we're practicing.
And you echoed something. I think Fran said another day, I can't remember, but I think it was you, the if only chant. Is that, is
no, it, that was somebody else.
Somebody else said that anyway. This pattern we get into, that things would be okay if only. And so you're talking about, you know, the people who want to drill and frack and all that. But it's true for all of us in every moment. I'm going back to what David said. You know, if only that person would learn to walk, if only I took the precepts, if only on. And this reality that everything is already Buddha, and you're included, but unbelievably. Well, no, maybe there is always one exception.
You know who you are.
that's one of those things. We can watch our thoughts arise. Wow, if only I, if only you.
We're a better Buddhist.
Whatever, fill in the blank.
So I'm going to bring this to a close, even though the energy in the room is quite alive. So noticing what's present for you as we talk about this. All of us, this is our life. And so we will continue exploring and expressing ourselves in silence.